Drew Marshall Show, reminding you that two thongs still don't make it right.
Hey folks, I want to welcome you back. You are listening to The Drew Marshall Show. We are streaming live at drewmarshall.ca, and of course we're live on Real Radio right here in Southern Ontario on Joy 1250. After writing an open letter to His Holiness the Dalai Lama in 06 and receiving supportive responses from his office, the Dalai Lama's office, Sean Hillman has been leading a public campaign to expose a cult in Toronto. Wow, is that called the Conservative Party? Sean spent 7 years living in the, I'm not even going to try to pronounce this, in a Buddhist temple, basically led by Carol Watt, and experienced firsthand the physical, emotional, and financial abuse of its leader. Since leaving in 01, he has been networking with other former residents and attendees who have been victims of Watt's abuse to understand their shared experiences and to take action so that her harms to sincere and vulnerable students of Buddhism cease. And the years that the blog has been live, where he's talking about all this, many former students and others concerned with those still trapped or recovering have reached out for support, and awareness has grown to the point where major media outlets, like this one, has taken interest in the story, but the cult, although diminished, still operates. So here to discuss a bit of his journey is Sean Hillman. Hi, Sean Hillman.
Hi there, Drew. Thanks for having me. International Women's Day.
Yeah. Well, you know, you guys wear robes, right? So, no. Who said that? Dude, how can you not be a monk anymore? I thought once a monk, always a monk. Don't you sign up for the 50... No, what is it? 50 billion year... no, that's Scientology. Wrong one.
When one takes the vows, one does intend to commit for life, but there is a way of exit. I mean, one can break one's vows, which wasn't the case for myself. Then the vows are done. At least the community considers that person to not be ordained anymore. But for good reason, one can leave the order. I mean, one isn't forced to remain in the order, and that wouldn't be healthy.
What was your reason?
Actually, I was thinking about it, especially today, given the significance of the day. It was definitely to be influenced by females. I'm now a happily married householder.
So you stopped being a monk because you wanted to get married?
That was part of it. Partnership was part of it, and the loneliness factor of being a solitary practitioner.
Yeah.
But the monastic lifestyle is not compatible to being close to females, and I have very many female friends. I was in a female-fronted rock band for 7 years. One of my closest friends.
As a monk?
The first couple of years, I started playing music again once I returned from India in 2005. I got back into playing music, which I hadn't done for about 15 years.
Okay, I know this is going to sound like a cheeky, immature question, but that's what this show is about. Did you ever be in the band? Dressed up in your monk stuff?
No, it's a good question.
That would have been awesome.
I did wear the colors. Also, as a caregiver in hospital, I wore the colors, but not the robes to suit the environment.
Right, right. I had Richard Thurman on the show last year. Have you ever met Richard?
Robert Thurman?
I mean, Robert, sorry.
Mm-hmm. Uma Thurman's dad. Yeah, he's an amazing translator. He actually just put out a piece clarifying the Dorje Shugden cult issue. It's a splinter group.
I just saw that. Mm-hmm. It was in HuffPost.
Really made it clear. It was in the Post, the Huffington Post. So he was on this show?
Yeah.
Amazing. Yeah, I'm a big fan. He was the first Westerner ordained by His Holiness the Dalai Lama. Still actually uses his first ordination name in some communications. I'm a big fan. He's a really amazing translator and Indologist.
Yeah. And what was the last one? Indologist?
Yes. And Tibetologist, actually, is probably more accurate.
Oh, okay. All right. But don't use big words with me, man. I don't know what's going on here.
A scholar of the Tibetan tradition.
Yeah, oligarchy. Told you I'd work that into the show somehow. How did you get into this? I mean, were you just sort of one of those, hippie high students that wanted to kind of buy into incense beads and shave your head because you're going bald anyway?
Interestingly, yes, that was part of it. I dabbled with Hinduism before I actually became a Buddhist in the early 90s. Once I started university, it was the first opportunity to take courses that I finally was able to take courses that I loved rather than those that was for monetary output or for a career. So I took poetry, intro to Buddhism, intro to Taoism. Fascinated by the Asian traditions, probably started with reading the autobiography or biography of Mahatma Gandhiji that was on my grandmother's bookshelf, of all places, a Jewish grandmother.
Wow.
And then got interested in Hinduism, also the Chinese traditions like Taoism. But it was really Buddhism and the texts. Particularly, there was one sutra, which is a discourse of the Buddha, that described the life of a wandering mendicant or monastic, and the themes of community, simplicity, basically focusing all of one's energy to become enlightened was very appealing to me. And I said to myself at that time, we're talking the early 90s now, if the Buddha was here now on the planet, I'd follow him. Some people in the Tibetan tradition consider His Holiness the Dalai Lama a Buddha himself. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So he was my guru. And actually around that time too, His Holiness the Dalai Lama visited Toronto. So there were various sort of signs, and also, I mean, I took them as signs and things pointing me towards the Tibetan tradition in particular, but towards Buddhism. And this is how eventually I became involved with this particular Buddhist community.
But where did you grow up?
I grew up in Toronto.
Okay, you know, it's not as though you grew up in some primarily Buddhist culture.
Oh, for sure not. Yeah, I had to crawl my way to the Dharma.
Right.
The
what did you grow up with? Judaism?
Yes, I was brought up as a Jew in an ultra-reform household, although when I was very little, around, you know, 5 to 8, I was in a Hebrew school by Chabad Lubavitch there, sort of a... they do a lot of outreach to help Jews. Their mission is to help Jews become better Jews. It was a free Hebrew school, so I came home screaming about the Mashiach, and I wanted the peyos, the curls. I wanted to wear the kippah and become a rabbi, and my parents immediately pulled me from that school because it wasn't compatible with their lifestyle.
Around
my bar mitzvah age, around my bar mitzvah age, I spent a lot of time in synagogue, another sort of revival period for me, and then some dabbling in Kabbalah. Around the time when I was flirting with the Asian traditions and starting to read those texts, I was also reading some of the exoteric Kabbalah texts, where the ideas of union, and I was questioning divinity and the nature of divinity and so on, because I grew up in this theistic tradition with some sort of devotion, but then the placement of that devotion sort of changed and still transforming over time, still transforming now.
Why do you think you have this devotion? Why it just seems to be changing so much. Like, you've changed a few times, mm-hmm. the way you sort of work out your devotion.
Right. It's hard to explain, and I don't know if I have a full explanation. I think part of it is karmic from previous lives. This connection that I have with the Indic traditions, not just Buddhism, but the various orders... In Hinduism, so-called Hinduism, such as Shaivism and Vaishnavism, Buddhism, Jainism. Well, actually, the majority of my research output has been on Jainism. I guess I have some sort of academic objectivity versus being a practicing Buddhist. So very much influenced by these traditions. I think it goes back in part to past lives, the karma developed over past lives.
So your mother, is she still alive?
Yes.
Okay, must happily. Be, even though she's still alive, rolling over in her grave at the stuff you're into, man.
No, so happy now. I mean,
really?
when I was a monk, and the future of the possibility of my having a family, for a Jewish mother, it's very devastating.
Yeah.
Also, I was quite cloistered when I was in the community in Toronto before I moved to India to sort of go to the source and finally study the scriptures in a Buddhist language and study the Tibetan language in India. That was sort of pulling away from this community and recovering from this community in Toronto. When I was in the community, she was deeply concerned because she saw signs of my oppression. I wasn't allowed to go back to school, wasn't allowed to volunteer outside of temple community, wasn't allowed even to connect with other Buddhists. I have a very close connection with various, pretty much all of the Buddhist, other Buddhist traditions in the city, the Sri Lankan, Laos, and so on. Mm. This was suppressed, and she could see that I wasn't really myself. I was definitely in transformation, which sometimes is a very painful process, like Khalil Gibran, your pain is the breaking of the shell that encloses your understanding. I was undergoing that pain, but also the other pain of being under someone's thumb and not being able to truly activate the way that I needed to.
Okay, folks, I want to let you know that Sean is in his third year of a PhD in the Department for the Study of Religion at the University of Toronto, with a double collaboration in bioethics and South Asian studies, you know, just as a hobby. Dude, that's like major cerebral stuff for a guy who's also into the heartbeat of it all,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, there's a soul thing happening here, and there's mm-hmm. a cognitive thing happening
right.
here.
Well, actually,
so do you ever feel mm-hmm, like you're sorry. Just absolutely insane? Because those are two mm-hmm. polar sides of approaching the religious mm-hmm. journey that you're on. Do
well,
you not think?
The tradition that I'm most connected to, that I sort of live in, is a Gelug tradition in Tibetan Buddhism, and they're known as the Brainiacs.
Oh.
When I was studying in India, one of my main activities was debating the texts, and the debate tradition in Tibetan Buddhism was very appealing to me. Long tradition of having debate partners, as you see in the yeshivas, where you have two people debating over the Torah. Very similar system of
right.
analyzing the scriptures by question and answer. And also very exciting, actually, in Tibetan debate, there's a lot of hoots and hollers and playful joking and actually almost wrestling where people are trying to get the right answer out. So it's very exciting, and I really enjoy the critical analysis of religion. It's certainly helped me. I had a teacher who was also, like myself, a former monk in the Korean tradition who took up academia, and he said that the more he critically analyzes the text, the less faith, if we could use that word, or the more secularized, he said, he has become.
That's kind of what I'm asking here.
For myself, though, I think the opposite actually is happening.
Really?
And when I get into the other texts, such as the early right now, I mean, I'm in full-blown reading mode for my exams, which are in May, so basically I'm spending all of my full-time reading, which sometimes definitely my brain feels like it's exploding. But as I am getting into these texts, the early Upanishadic texts in the Hindu tradition, and the epics like the Mahabharata and the Ramayana, there's a lot of internal stuff that's happening too, at sort of in tandem with the critical analysis that's happening. So
okay.
I can't explain it fully, but I would say that, like your theme for the show, doubt is more compatible than certainty. I find this too. I mean, the more I analyze, it's not that my doubts are resolved, but more questions come up, and I find this very exciting.
Right, right. Okay, take a breath here for a second. I guess what I'm trying to get here is, if I was to go further down the study of world religions and really lap up as much as I could and just go shotgun blast all over the world and take in everything I could, there's a part of me that would sort of surmise that I would get to a point where I would almost solomonize, but that sounds a little too close to something else. I'd get to a point where I'd go, it's all worthless. It's all meaningless. It's all,
Because of the diversity?
Yeah, because of, I guess what I'm trying to say is, it would just seem like man scrambling in such, but I meant mankind. Man.
I'm with you.
Yeah, scrambling in futility to understand the ununderstandable, the incomprehensible.
It seems like
an exercise in futility.
Well, it may seem that way. I mean, from my own perspective, I think that there are – I mean, I firmly believe that there are people who have transformed greatly through these systems, and also that these systems, these religious systems, don't work for everybody. And I think that the variation in the systems is very important because of the variation of dispositions that we have. I could say that there are as many religions as there are people, especially with the Indic traditions. This word Hinduism is very problematic. Even Buddhism, there are so many different traditions. But within each tradition, each practitioner, and also there's a saying in Tibet that every Lama is his own lineage. So I think it's based on people's disposition. For me, certain parts of the religious system, I mean, I question certain aspects of the Buddhist texts and certain practices. Some I'm drawn to. Some I go through phases where, right now, not so sure about the tantric aspect, this secret aspect. I don't feel qualified. Sometimes I'm sort of drawn to it. You know, these things change over time. And it's a changing practice, and individuals need to practice according to their capacity. But
foundationally, and as simple as we can have this conversation, what is the reason for someone to be involved in a particular religious tribe? And I can see two main ones. Mm-hmm. I know there's a plethora of them, but simplify it, boil it down. You belong to a religious tribe in order to change yourself, to find peace, or cerebrally, to understand it. And mm-hmm. if you get to the point where you see so many inconsistencies or hypocrisies, especially not only just in the writings, but in the people who are living that in that tribe, that would cause you to say, no, thanks. Mm. Another one is, I'm not really changing as a person, so why would I be involved in this tribe mm-hmm. anymore? So, am I missing something?
Personally, it's helped me greatly. I mean, you sort of divided the development of personal peace and I guess we could call it, in the Buddhist context, we call it trying to understand reality or try to perceive it directly. I don't think those are in opposition. I don't think it – I mean, it depends on the person and where they're at and the tradition they're involved in. But this search for personal liberation / peace doesn't have to be entirely selfish. It could be in order to better – and this is where we can bring on other systems, like in the northern schools of Buddhism. There's a combination of the personal liberation practices and wanting to benefit others. There's a word called bodhicitta, which is this compassionate wish to become enlightened for the sake of others, which benefits oneself too, as included within this umbrella of others. So Yeah, you got to jump in there. I just lost my train of thought.
I was being polite, and he's like, rescue me, rescue me. Okay, so what I want to know directly from you, Sean,
So what I was saying is the practice
see,
of personal...
It
came back. The practice of personal liberation can be combined with the practice of helping others, and the two can be complementary to each other. And so your question about it may not be transforming me, or I'm seeing so many inconsistencies or dissonances between what people say they're doing and what people are doing, or people are saying that these negative actions, what we might agree on as negative actions, are actually okay in the grand scheme of things because of their motivation or some things like this. I mean, it depends. There's the whole gamut of responses to these possibilities, but I've experienced by practicing the Dharma that it actually has helped me. And I've met people who I want to become like, such as my gurus or my lamas.
Okay, that last part, I'm glad you brought that up, because I think that's the hook for most people. You hang out, you know, that's why the frontline proselytizers are usually not the ugly, grumpy people, because it doesn't help people come in, you know, come into the tribe, come into the fold.
Saying.
And the love bomb concept, you know, the Scientologists, the evangelicals, the J-dubs, the door knockers, whatever, you know.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned missionary work. There's sort of a paradox within the Buddhist tradition. In the early texts, the Buddha is quoted as saying, go out to his monks, the early order, and, you know, we're talking the mid-500 BCE, go out for the good of the many, which sounds like a missionary push. And then there's something, a corrective within the tradition, which is one cannot teach unless under very specific circumstances. One of those circumstances is that one is asked to teach. So it's a genuine interest by another.
So shut up until you're asked?
In some cases, not just asked once, but asked three times, and, you know, first, oh, and, you know, I really don't have anything to offer, you should probably go to someone else, or just, you know, rely on yourself, and then the next time, please, could you please teach? You know, I don't really know, maybe, and then the next, could you please teach? Sure.
I'll do what I can.
It won't be much.
Just came out there. Hey, I'm gonna chill.
It won't be much, but then it turns out when someone like His Holiness the Dalai Lama does this all the time, oh, I really can't offer you much, and then this amazing erudite Dharma discourse, full of humility and humor, suddenly comes out, and we're like, he was just leading us on. He does have something to offer, but with the practice of humility, one says, I really don't have that much to offer, when in fact they do.
This is actually a good time for us to let our listeners know a couple things. First of all, you're listening to The Drew Marshall Show. We're streaming live at drewmarshall.ca, and we are on Joy 1250 right now as you are listening to us in your radio, in your car, maybe. Also, on your smartphone, you can get the TuneIn app and listen to us live right there, and also our podcast. But also just want to let you know that last year we did a thing called Soul Survivor, where it was kind of a takeoff on the television show. Five religious tribes competed for the soul of one person. The tribes that competed for the soul of Catalina, tribe Mormon, tribe Muslim, tribe Jesus, tribe Buddhism, or Buddhist, and tribe Hare Krishna. And we had leaders from all of those tribes speak to our Soul Survivor contestant, Catalina. And what an honor for her. She just was so thrilled to be able to speak to those people. So that was amazing. So we are looking for our new Soul Survivor contestant. And if you have not landed in any particular tribe, maybe you're an agnostic, I don't know, whatever, or an ex-this or an ex-that, as long as you don't come in with a boatload of bias, we sure would love to have you as our Soul Survivor contestant. So you can go to our website and send us an email. And I think you can go to the Soul Survivor, click on the Soul Survivor link. That'll tell you more about what we did last year as well. Anyway, that's when we had Robert Thurman on. He was a representative of Tribe Buddhism.
A great rep.
Yeah, great rep. Mr. Lama was busy. By the way, I've got to talk about him for a second, and then I want to talk about the cult in Toronto.
His Holiness just spent his first Tibetan New Year outside of India.
Did he not just open the Senate, too, or something like that?
Yeah, he did the opening prayer. It was funny because he kind of joked about his broken English when he went to the translation part, because he did the prayers predominantly in the Tibetan language.
Right.
And he's used to, I mean, maybe they didn't have mics on the audience, but he's used to laughter when he jokes about his own broken English.
Yeah.
No laughter. And then also said that, you know, as a humble Buddhist monk, I'm obviously going to pray to the Buddha and all the other gods. And I thought that this was an inclusive, it sounds polytheistic, but which I mean, in the Buddhist cosmology, we embrace the various gods that you find in the Hindu system, but not as an ultimate refuge, but as players in this cosmic drama. Interesting that he said that. But he could have said also all the other gods and the monotheistic gods that people embrace. But I think he was trying to be inclusive when he said that, and then talked about developing a warm heart for the benefit of all beings.
Okay, well, this is what I have to say about the Dalai Lama. And I honestly mean no disrespect. His shtick is his laugh. I listened to the interview he did live on HuffPost last week or the week before. I watched the whole thing, and I was trying to understand and comprehend the content. Because I've been wooed by this old man in a robe laughing. But I wanted to get below the laughter. Mm-hmm. I was not enthralled. I was not, I did not gravitate towards the content of what this gentleman has to say. And during our last year's Soul Survivor, our contestant, Catalina, she chose Buddhism. That was the tribe she chose at the end of the contest.
Gotcha.
And someone said to me, well, of course she chose that because that's the one with the least amount of commitment. Not commitment. That was the one that requires the least of you.
Hmm. Interesting.
That's what I thought, too. So how do you respond to that? In other words, I think what they were saying was, well, of course they chose that one in today's day and age. It's got the least sort of bite to it. It's the most accepting, pluralistic, kumbaya thing, you know, hug a whale, kiss a tree, and
it's
light some
one
incense.
Of my relatives who is expressly agnostic from a Jewish background similarly says that out of all of the traditions, he's mostly drawn to Buddhism. And actually, I hear this a lot. But in terms of, you know, I mean, we could jump on the commitment factor.
Yeah, that was a bad word because I realize it takes a big commitment. I think.
Okay, so we're talking about the feel-good factor.
Yeah.
And you know, kumbaya and, you know, loving others. I mean, I think it's natural for people to be drawn to a tradition that emphasizes kindness. Mm-hmm. There is also, like the two wings of the bird, there's the compassionate side. And I differentiate it, as the Buddhist tradition does, between love and compassion. Love being wanting others to be happy, and compassion wanting others to be free from suffering and pain. And the other wing of the bird is wisdom, the development of wisdom, trying to understand how things work, both phenomenology and both how the human psycho-spiritual system works in order to get a handle on things and transform one's own life by changing one's behavior and one's actions to have a better future. But in the grand scheme of things, a better future not for its own sake, but if you combine it with what we were saying earlier about a concern for others, more effectively able to help others. So feel good, I mean, sure. I mean, I don't contest that. There's a lot of hard work over the course, according to the text, of many eons, which is a very lengthy period of time.
But that's only if you're trying to, isn't that only, if you're trying to kind of go up the ladder mm-hmm. towards enlightenment and position within the tribe.
Right. So, or over the course of lives, you know, we could distinguish between the motivation to have a better rebirth and, you know, the motivation could be like a healthy, selfish one. I want to have a better rebirth because I'm having some problems now that I don't want to have in the future. And then the next level, I want to have a better rebirth with resources, with a good appearance. You were mentioning teachers having a good appearance, bringing people into the fold, so that one can better influence others to help themselves, not for the sake of being
So you're saying I want to rock this Buddhist thing so that when I die and come back, I can rock it even better and I can enjoy life even better.
Enjoyment, sure. I mean, the enjoyment increases, but also the sensitivity to other people's pain, which is difficult, would increase too, which I think is a natural part of developing more sensitivity, which is definitely part of the various Buddhist paths.
Man, I'm so far down the sensitivity scale. I'm going to come back as a slug or something. It's just going to be shocking. Okay, what's
going on? We need you to talk to people.
What's going on with the cult, man? First of all,
well, actually, it's interesting. I just poked my head around the corner because actually, you were located around the corner from the Department of Study of Religion. I just wanted to see because I had heard. I have various informants. Everybody so far is confidential. Nobody wants to put their name on the line, like myself, which I absolutely understand. And
sounds like House of Cards.
We're all victims of abuse who have been part of this group and have left. Various stages and various periods of time it takes to recover. I could say it's not fully done with me. I still have dreams now and then. But I waited long enough before writing His Holiness and before starting this public campaign, which started with the blog, which I think has been quite influential. Waited until I felt that it wasn't a vendetta, it wasn't out of bitterness. You know, not that my intention is perfect, but that really it's a concern for the leader who is perpetrating these harms, because there are karmic results for that, very serious karmic results, according to the karmic system in Buddhism, of being a teacher and misusing that position. Mm. And for the people who are still there, and people connected to the people who are still there, and the people who have left, and the people who are connected to the people who have left, these, all these groups of people. So just an update, they've moved. They had a prime location. I think it's significant that, so the emphasis now is not being in the hub of Toronto, although they could have remained there if the mortgage was paid
off. They've probably gone to a more seclusive place or reclusive place.
When I saw their garbage, which actually had put part of it had been put on another person's property, which is very interesting. It could be the new owners of the property that had moved their garbage that was out front to another. But
Are you going through people's garbage?
Well, I went to take a look and I saw a pile of burgundy-colored garbage not on their property and it was like covered with dog hair. But the big illuminated sign of His Holiness the Dalai Lama is down, you know, the loose wires. Their other illuminated sign, which you can see from Spadina Station, was all very strategic. The one of His Holiness you can see from Bloor Street looking up the street. It's a significant location. They're not there anymore. And my first thought was that now she can go off into hiding with her very few disciples that are left from what I've heard.
Sure.
And polish her gold like Smaug in the Hobbit story.
Yes.
You know, they've been more and more going under the radar, whereas before she was a public figure on various committees like the Ontario Multi-Faith Committee, our author of the Buddhist section years ago of a multi-faith manual for
Sean,
Catholics.
Where are they?
I don't know. I mean, this is remains to be seen.
They've totally gone off the grid.
Well, for now, but, you know, I'll find out where they are. And, I mean, the question is, are they going to be a public group anymore? It's possible that they won't.
How did you get into it?
When I was at U of T, I approached my professor, Professor Leonard Priestley, who is an Indologist and also a scholar of Chinese culture and religions. I asked him if there were any communities in Toronto, and he pointed to another professor at U of T at Trinity College named Suwana Sugunasiri, who's been very involved.
I'm sorry, named what?
A Sri Lankan, living Sri Lankan Buddhist, and my first living Buddhist that I met in this lifetime. This other professor said,
Say his name again, though.
Suwanda Sugunasiri.
So cool, man.
I've said it a lot, so it just rolls off the tongue.
Yeah.
And he told me about this nun who had a temple and spoke English, which is one of the troubles of people trying to connect with the Buddhist tradition and other Buddhists is the language barrier because, you know, in some of the Chinese temples, like the first one that I visited when I was first wanting to reach out into the Buddhist community, I actually took refuge on the property of a Chinese Buddhist temple on Bayview Avenue, and they're the ones that are involved in the dispute.
What do you mean you took refuge? It sounds like you're running from something.
Let me just finish this train of thought, and I'll tell you about refuge. Cham Shan is now refuting the decision by the Ministry of Environment to allow the Sumac Ridge wind project in the Kawarthas. One of the four wind projects has withdrawn. There are three more to go. They've been developing a retreat center over the course of a decade and $20 million invested by their donors. So I took refuge on their property in the early days, like late 80s, early 90s. Taking refuge is the formal commitment to being a Buddhist, and there are various, at the time I didn't know what these vows were, but there are various refuge vows, which are aside and distinguished from the householder ethical vows, there are various levels of those, and the monastic vows.
So basically, you're jacking up your Buddhist thing by staying on a property.
No, it was the first chance I had to be in front of a Buddhist statue, and I, you know, between the Buddha and myself, in my heart, I said, I want to be a Buddhist, and that's when I became a Buddhist on that day.
Wow. Okay, first warning sign, first red flag that this place you were involved with was
so when
wacky.
I got involved, I mean, the warning sign was right off the bat, but I took it as a positive sign. We were chatting when I showed up late at night. It was a difficult time for me. I was newly left home in the physical sense, not in the metaphysical sense, because becoming ordained is also called leaving home or the going forth. We were chatting around the kitchen table where a lot of these impromptu teachings happened. She asked me about my long hair. I had a huge afro, long hair and a hat.
I had an afro too.
Yeah, and yes. we're both hairless.
Bald. Yes.
And I became kind of dizzy when she questioned where I was at and how I was manifesting my appearance. I got woozy and I almost fell off my
seat.
It was how I understand it is that it was the first time someone kind of saw me or wanted to see behind how I was presenting myself. But in the early days, the warning signs, how she treated people from the outset, it got worse and worse. And I have to say I contributed to this communal devotion increase, especially based on a particular text on guru devotion, to stand up when the guru enters the room. This guru-disciple relationship is tricky because this particular relationship was just a Buddhist nun and her students, which became more and more corrupt. The guru-disciple relationship is tantric context, which is completely different. We don't have to get into that. But I was using these tantric texts to influence how we behaved with our guru, pulling out her seat, serving her, making sure she had delicious
food.
Don't
understand. Give me an example. I have no clue what you're talking about.
About guru devotion?
No, about just behaviors. These tantric chants while you're pulling out a chair. I think that's what you said.
Sorry,
I didn't get
tantric texts that encourage the student to treat their guru in a particular way with high devotion and various forms of respect,
so
like service.
So you read some stuff that said you should be you should treat this your leader with respect
for the guru, but this was just a nun with her students. So basically,
so you shouldn't have given her so much respect.
Well, I mean, if it had worked out that she wasn't going to take the power and misuse it, who knows what would have happened? But it turns out that the more power we invested in her, the more she misused it. One of the major, I mean, the reason why I left was the temple, for all intents and purposes, became a dog kennel. And there are restrictions in the Buddhist monastic code about breeding and particularly selling animals.
Oh,
and
you're serious about, like, literal, it became a dog kennel.
Literally became a dog kennel.
I mean,
we sort of worked on the vision for the community together over time, and then she just veered off, got a dog, started breeding them without our consent, and the board it was crippled from the beginning because she wrote into the board's mandate that there would be veto power. So we're not acting as a collective decision-making body. It's basically we could make
suggestions. Was this to make money?
It's hard to say, but yes, there was money-making because she sold the dogs. She showed the dogs. And I'll never forget seeing her face after she won a particular show, the sort of joy in winning in a competitive sphere.
Kind of anti-Buddhist, isn't it?
Didn't seem very Buddhist to me. No. From the outset, the big concern with the tastiness of food was troubling to me right from the outset. The fact that we couldn't keep vows that we were supposed to as monastics because she didn't like not eating after midday. I was disallowed from doing this practice, which actually I was deeply interested in. And when I left the community and became a fully ordained monk, I practiced this fasting after midday until sunrise the next day for 6 years. A very powerful practice. The logic is to develop resources, the karmic resources for future lives, but also to practice of discipline and moderation
okay.
and food eating.
All right. Please do me a favor because
sure.
we have – let me just look at the clock here. We have about 6 minutes
okay.
left. We've already gone over 9 minutes. I want to go six more. That's how fast this half hour
was. Do you want to do more warning signs or
no,
move on?
No. I want you just to – help me get what you're trying to say across to the listeners better
okay.
by dumbing it down for us.
Okay.
Okay? We don't have intelligent listeners.
No, I'm kidding. I doubt that. But I hear you saying that I'm talking way up there in the stratosphere. So
how
bring it
I want to know the wackiest thing this place does or did.
Well, there's whatever. Physical abuse. She
you
hits
were hit?
People. I was hit, and then I started to refuse to be hit. And then
well, how are you hit?
Slapped in the face. I saw someone basically wrestled to the ground, and since I left...
By a nun?
Yes. Since I left... And you have to remember that, you know, we wouldn't lash out, like with a mother, we wouldn't lash out because of that respect and devotion. And it's very confusing when you have someone that you've given your life over in many ways harming you in that way, and very much against the text. Even though, I mean, one could point to Zen monastic discipline where the meditator's falling asleep and they give them a whack on the back, or the discipline of young monks and nuns with these sort of, kind of sticks or like...
Tasers.
I would say whips, but they're not quite whips, okay. but just very light. But anyhow...
Was there sexual abuse?
No. But let me just finish with the physical abuse.
Yep.
Also, someone had laceration on their face from a bowl being thrown at their face, and I've also heard of a broken arm and a broken nose from various informants.
But see, this is the thing I don't get. If it's one thing if a big dude is
yes.
rocking the scene there, and you are terrified and intimidated because of brute strength,
mm-hmm.
but unless she's an ex, you know, Russian shot putter, I think what this is coming down to is you allowed this to
yes.
happen because of the code that you were agreeing to live by.
Yeah, and
you
she it's interesting you say code. She tried to have us sign a document saying that we wouldn't hold her accountable for the various teaching methods, which included these, and if someone was spit on too, including these physical abuses,
right.
Because she would continuously tell us that they were for our benefit to wake us up because we were so
right.
numb and
okay,
dumb.
Okay, she's a little high strung. Mm. She's, let's say, abusive. Okay, a little whack here and the wrestling thing.
She has mental health problems.
Okay,
yeah.
Without a doubt, I think we could probably, I shouldn't say without a doubt, but from the things I'm hearing, okay, I get this. So I guess it's, you know, the same outsider question always
mm-hmm.
comes up. An outsider would say, leave.
How did you allow it? I mean, and we do. And I would say everybody will, and most people have. There are a few stragglers.
Yeah.
Most people have left because of these inconsistencies between the, you know, normative prescriptions and Buddhist practice and these very dissonant, descriptive, on-the-ground behaviors.
But, Sean, it's got to – okay, aside from – what did or didn't happen, aside from the fact that you were submitting yourself to a controlling person, which, I mean, my goodness, you know, that goes on in city council.
I think vulnerability too, plays
right?
into this.
Yeah, exactly. So I want to talk to you personally about this. Dude, that's got to suck. Like, you got to look back on that and go, that hurts, man. I mean, I poured out my heart, my soul, literally, you know, everything, and I surrendered and submitted to you. And you literally spit at me. You literally hurt me.
It's true. Trying to avoid becoming emotional. There are textual precedents for people who have placed their devotion wrongly in a guru that is, or a lama, or a teacher at the least, that's not appropriate, doesn't have the appropriate qualifications. And, you know, see this in the stories of Jesus too, you know, your faith healed you, and some of these quotes. That devotion itself, I think, is transformative, and that's why, even though it was misplaced in someone that I should not have placed my devotion in, I came in with a devotion to the Buddhist tradition and practices, and His Holiness the Dalai Lama and other teachers. I think that's why I was able to come out still wanting to practice Buddhism, still wanting to have a teacher-student relationship, very wary of these Western centers and how they're run. Some are more healthy than others. I've seen various levels of health in these Western Dharma centers of various traditions. And also coming out wanting to further pursue my studies in Buddhist academia.
But, man, no matter how you cut it, there's, you know, dude, I saw your face change, your body position change, your eyes got a little welly. I don't think that's a real word, but anyway.
Yeah,
where is that coming from?
It's a mixture. I mean, it's a sadness at the failure of that relationship. Sadness at the repercussions on the person, Carol herself, and a sadness at all of the harms over time, and the loss of this vision of what was at one time a burgeoning Buddhist community that could have been very helpful to the local community and the Toronto community. And maybe,
but you didn't
well
up
way,
with tears because a local Buddhist community started out good and then tanked.
It's definitely a part of my emotional makeup. But sure, being struck by someone who I placed, I guess I can't say all of my eggs, you know, because somehow I got out without intervention, with the help of my family, but without someone coming in and dragging me out and deprogramming. Lots of help for sure, but I was able to extract myself. You know, how could I? I know how I could. I was quite vulnerable.
Sure.
I was longing for so strongly into a community. And there were some internal mythologies that helped too, in that she told us that she could help us die better for a better rebirth. And that was heavily influential on my – I packed up to leave several times. And that was one of the things that kept me, strangely enough.
You – you know, there's a part of me that sort of says, and I know there's, I can, I'm just trying to pull from my vacuous brain some scriptures in whatever sacred texts that would say things like, don't be surrendering to that much to another human being.
There is this discourse too in Tibetan Buddhism, because there are other examples of this guru devotion problem where lamas take advantage of their students.
Right.
So His Holiness often says this in public talks, don't invest too much, and that you should spend even up to 12 years checking your teacher out before you do this giving over. I mean, I was just very enthusiastic, a very young, budding, wannabe monastic, I guess, at the time. And like I said, it progressively devolved over time. It wasn't as bad as it had become in the beginning. Mm-hmm. And by that time, when more warning signs came, I was deeply invested. I was a senior student. What was never going to happen in this community is for her to, even though when I left she told me, oh, I thought of you as sort of like, she didn't say the word successor, but like a heart son, which is only a term used in the Tibetan tradition posthumously. No lama says you're my heart son or my heart daughter. But that somehow I would be involved in the future of this organization after she left. There is nothing outside of her that is this organization, because it's all about her. She started calling herself lifetime spiritual director. There's no precedent for this in the Buddhist tradition.
Sean, why do you think
in charities?
Why do you think you surrendered so much to her? Why did you surrender?
Well, she's a very charismatic person, and maybe I haven't mentioned this, very talented and very intelligent despite her mental health issues. And there's this split. In the morning, she would berate us before she would go to work. And then at night, she'd come home and be all flowers, and we'd cook dinner and have a great time together. So it was a very mixed experience, mutual benefit in both ways. But the harms on her end outweighed the benefit.
But what is it about you Because not everybody would surrender to something like that, mm-hmm. right? What is it about you that that's surrender to well, someone wanted, someone yes. so holy?
I didn't
a,
see...
W-H.
Yes, I didn't see any other opportunities for myself. I just, like I said, I just left home, and I before then was so... enmeshed with my family that I didn't have any other opportunities until I left to really explore other spiritual traditions. That's part of it. And I don't know, I think I purposefully blinded myself to some of them because of the other beneficial aspects of this relationship and this community life. And community life was a big part of it.
Yeah.
It still is a major formative communal experience that I've had. And lots of us who have left stay in touch. Sort of, we talked about it earlier on the phone, but it's sort of a loose network, hard to call it a group, sort of disenfranchised. We're all very wary, but many of us still deeply interested in
you know what, man?
Practice.
I have never met someone who is as cerebrally involved in all this stuff as you are, who also has their heart on their sleeve as much as you do. You just stink of love. it reeks out of you, man. You just...
I don't know what to say. All I can say is that, and I'll say this on this day, that everybody in my life has helped me become who I am, whatever it is that I've become, particularly the female influence. And I'm a happy householder now. I'm happy to have had the experiences of being a monastic and the training from my teachers and the texts.
Is your dad in your life?
Yes, yeah. Yeah, we've definitely warmed up to each other, and he's become more mellow.
Are your mom and dad still together?
Yes, yeah. They live in Uxbridge.
And did they... They probably wouldn't know. Oh, I've got so many questions. I'm out of time here, man. Okay, let me just wrap this up. I'm really, really, really sorry that you stuck your neck out like that for community, for relationship, for camaraderie, for love. Really, at the bottom of the whole mm-hmm. thing, and pretty much got it chopped off. That's horrible. And I'm really sorry that went down. You seem like the kind of guy who. Who will? Oh, I hate this. You're using this this proverbial phrase, but you know you're gonna take lemons and make lemonade out of it, right? You seem like the kind of guy who's mm-hmm. gonna go through life eyes wide open, so you'll be okay. And I don't know. I want to keep track of where you go because of this. And folks, you know, over the radio, you're not getting the body language here. You know, you're hearing. You're hearing Sean. I mean, dude, you have just rocked like about 10,000 words in the last little while here, right? You have just educated and illuminated and just thrown down a ton of stuff. But Sean's body language is, as I said, yeah. I mean, you stink of love. This is getting weird now.
Nice,
I don't know where
nice,
I'm going with
nice
this.
It's nice to meet you. We should stay in touch, and I'll keep you posted on that situation and the other activities.
If you find that this organization sticks their head up again, I would like to know more about where and why and what's going on because it drives me nuts. See, I actually hate religion. This is going to be I don't know.
You and my wife should go bowling.
What I'm trying to say is. When man thinks that they can do something to get right with the other, however you all want to define the other, when man thinks they need to do X, Y, or Z in order to get right with the other, inevitably, over the history of mankind, that has led to a whole lot of wacky, negative junk. Mm-hmm. And so if you go to hellwithreligion.com, mm-hmm. I think that's a fascinating website for you to go to.
His Holiness Dalai Lama often says that if we need to do away with religion in order to be better people and develop a harmonious world, we should do it.
I think I heard him say that.
Yes. And then he also often says is religion is kindness and love. So, you know, we're with you. I mean, in a way, there is no Buddhism, even though I say, oh, I'm a Buddhist and I really am influenced by the Buddhist system and I utilize it. When we all get along, we won't need Buddhism.
I would love to ask you, I've got so many questions, I'd love to ask you about, you know, growing up where you grew up, you know, what do you think about Jesus, but mm-hmm. We'll have that discussion.
It's a taboo subject in a Jewish household, in our Jewish household.
Yeah, yeah. That's what I was just...
And I mean, reading the Gospels secretly in my room when I was flirting with all the various traditions, including in the Gospels, uncomfortable, but I...
Would it have been better for you to be caught with porn?
Perhaps. I remember I put a picture of the Buddha on my door. It was sort of like, I'm a Buddhist. I mean, it was very just ballsy, I guess, yeah. with Not only that, but with a flaming halo, a halo of flames, and a swastika on the chest, which is an ancient Indian symbol of various meanings, stability and purity and so on, totally misappropriated and misused.
Yeah, but didn't go over to well the
Jewish
house.
Well, actually, surprisingly, they were very, you know, I have to say that, but you mentioned my parents, they were very understanding, always concerned, even when it seemed like I was in big trouble with this community, always supportive of my musical activities and just loving all around. So thanks to them, that has helped me get through this and to carry on.
Sean just made the big trip all the way out here to Oakville from the Big Smoke. Thanks for coming across.
My pleasure. Thanks
Appreciate
for having
it.
Me.
Yeah, it was great. Sean Hillman, former Buddhist monk and former cult member as well. Again, that's got to be in your Labolite profile. Oh, wait, you're married. Hey, folks, I want to tell you about the Drew Marshall Show 1250 special. You ready for this? For $12.50, that's right, only $12.50, we'll mention your organization's name, website, and a brief description. Did you catch that? During each show, we'll read out your organization's name, website, and a brief description for only $12.50. Now, obviously, there's no point in doing that only once during a four-hour show, so we'll read your advertisement four times per show for an entire month, and each time we do it, it'll only cost you $12.50. It's kind of like putting an advertisement up on every church bulletin in the GTA, except you don't have to get permission from that grumpy old lady at the front desk. Now look, because there are limited spots available for our 1250 special, why don't you call us right now, toll-free, on 877-JOY-1250. Now sure, we're right in the middle of things here in the show, but if you call us right now, toll-free, on 877-JOY-1250, we'll take your name and number and call you back on Monday to sign up for the Drew Marshall Show 1250 special. This is nuts. Are you sure we want to do this? How am I supposed to make any money?